I wondered aloud yesterday who in Michigan might have enforcement authority over anyone buzzing a bald eagle's nest with a drone. There is some evidence, anecdotal evidence, that someone has been doing that at Lansing's new bald eagle nest on the Red Cedar River. I want to thank a few listeners at the DNR who called me later in the day yesterday. This is still a bit preliminary because I haven't had time to look under every rock in this by any means, but preliminarily, it appears both state statutes and federal statutes may prohibit this activity. Tammy Pullen is a conservation officer with the DNR. She emailed me a few sentences from the state's General Hunting and Trapping Regulations from Section 2.1. A person shall not, I'll paraphrase a bit here, a person shall not molest, harass, or annoy those birds upon their nests. Those birds refers to birds protected by the laws of this state. And I have to assume that the bald eagle of all birds is protected by the state's Endangered Species Act of 1974. So that is a little bit of an update there on that score. Lansing, of course, does have its first bald eagle's nest in maybe a century on the Red Cedar River. It is Current State here on WKAR. Tuesday is here. I'm Mark Bayshore. The day millions of Americans have been anticipating is here. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court hears oral arguments in a series of cases focusing on the constitutionality of same-sex marriage. 36 states currently allow the practice. Michigan is not one of them. Michigan joins three other states, Ohio, Kentucky, and Tennessee, in defending their bans. The High Court will decide whether gay marriage should be allowed at all, and if so, if states that ban them must recognize such marriages performed in other states where the practice is legal. Now, the Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta is in Washington today to witness the opening arguments at the U.S. Supreme Court. Just a short while ago, I spoke with Rick and first asked him to describe where he's at and what he's seeing.
Well, I am actually standing in front of the Supreme Court building. It's it's an old Greek Revival building, lots of columns and all of that. And federal court rules, not just the Supreme Court, but all federal courts, you're not allowed to demonstrate on the steps or the plaza in front of it. And so everyone is kind of packed onto the sidewalk. And so you've got lots of people who are holding signs that are, you know, supportive of marriage equality, same-sex marriage, but also a lot of people holding signs that talk about homosexuality as being a sin and same-sex marriage as being wrong. And so, you know, and all of these people, these adversaries on this particular issue are packed shoulder to shoulder and kind of doing their own thing.
There are really two key questions at the heart of these cases that have been consolidated into one. Can you explain what they are?
Sure. There are several points that the court has to cover, but probably the two key ones, and this is where the Michigan case and the Ohio state, what they really zero in on, is first of all, do states have to recognize same-sex marriage? That is there a constitutional right for lesbian and gay couples to get married and have all of the rights and privileges that are associated with that? And that's an equal protection argument. And then there's one that's really a contract argument, a full faith and credit argument, which is, do states have to recognize marriages that are performed in other states where it's legal? Because marriage is a contract, and states are obligated by the United States Constitution to recognize contracts that are performed in other states, but with, you know, rare exceptions.
The ramifications of a pro vote seem pretty clear. Same-sex marriage would be legal in all 50 states, but what could come from a no vote on the questions? Would states that once had bans that were overturned reinstate those bans?
Well, we don't know. That would, you know, it would depend not just on what the Supreme Court rules and sort of the philosophical issue, but then, you know, how it frames its resolution. that they could throw it back to the states to resolve, you know, go back to ballot questions. It could say, you know what, we're going to keep things as they are everywhere. However, you know, no new ones that it could actually, you know, the court could conceivably rule that while there is no basic right to for gay and lesbian couples to marry, there is a responsibility for courts to recognize contracts. So states could continue to be allowed to ban marriages within their borders while still being forced to recognize marriages performed in places where it's legal. That they're really, there's a lot of possibilities on the spectrum here.
We're talking with Rick Pluta, the State House Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. He's in Washington today to cover the opening arguments in the U.S. Supreme Court's case to define the legality of same-sex marriage. Rick, Michigan's constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage was enacted in 2004. Much of this case, now before the Supreme Court, hinges on how aggressively the state will have to defend its ban. And the court uses different levels of scrutiny in deciding such cases. What does that mean?
Well, now, both sides are saying that they think they can win regardless of what level of scrutiny the court applies. But what that is really about is, historically, the court has to make a decision on how vigorously a state has to defend a law or a policy. And the lowest level of scrutiny is called rational basis. And that is one where it just says, look, was this a reasonable decision for the policymakers, whether it be a legislature or voters, to make? It doesn't have to be a good decision. It doesn't have to be a best decision. It just has to be reasonably arrived at. That's pretty easy to defend. The state is saying that we have this tradition of what marriage always looked like, and so this was, you know, a rational thing for voters to arrive at. And the pro-gay marriage side, the April DeBoer, Jane Rouse team, are saying that regardless of how long it's been around, it is irrational because of how it's been applied and how it denies, you know, rights and benefits, insurance, you know, visitation, things like that, to couples to the benefit of no one. But then you start moving. So that's the argument, even if they use the lowest, you know, the lowest level. But then you move up, and you know how, you know, again, how hard is the court going to force Michigan and the other states to defend their marriage bans all the way up to the strictest level of scrutiny, and it is called strict scrutiny. And in that case, you have to, the court will say, you know what, it is discrimination. And so in order to uphold this policy, you have to show that there is really a compelling state purpose that requires this policy and that it's applied as narrowly as possible. It's a standard that's usually applied in racial discrimination cases, and it is a very difficult one for a policy to withstand.
In the Michigan case, the two defendants that you refer to, Jane Rouse and April DeBoer, say the ban violates their civil rights.
Mm-hmm.
Attorney General Bill Schuette says this is about the rights of voters, not the courts, to determine the law. How seriously will SCOTUS consider that argument, popular will versus legislative action?
Well, I mean, that was... they'll have to consider it seriously because that was the basis of the decision that came out of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, the only decision in any jurisdiction in the country, any federal jurisdiction in the country, where these bans were upheld. And what Judge Sutton said in the majority opinion was actually that we know that same-sex marriage is going to be the law of the land, that trend is clear. The question is, how will we arrive at that? Will it be through judicial fiat? Or will it be because state by state, the nation has reached a consensus on the question? And so, you know, I mean, that is the Michigan case.
Going into the case, Rick, what do we know about both the conservative leanings and the liberal leanings of the nine justices? And do their past decisions give us any sense about how they might rule?
Well, you know what? There are hints that you can draw, but you've got to be careful, you know, on some of the major decisions that might, you know, that we might draw on this, that, you know, one justice or another was recused, that you know, Anthony Kennedy certainly moves back and forth on these questions. You know, the state is hoping that the court winds up with a majority, something like they did on the Michigan affirmative action case. That decision was reached just about a year ago, or was released just about a year ago, where they said that courts really need to give a lot of deference to what voters decide. There are reasons for both sides to harbor both, you know, some optimism and some pessimism. And, you know, it's trying to read what the Supreme Court can do can certainly be tricky business.
Rick Pluta out on a very crowded sidewalk in front of the U.S. Supreme Court in Washington, D.C. Rick is the State House Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Thank you, Rick.
Oh, my pleasure, Mark.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Catch us every weekday at noon on AM 870 WKAR. From March Madness to April showers, the signs of spring have been making their arrival in Michigan these past few weeks. You've probably also noticed a few more bird songs accompanying those first rays of morning light, sometimes before your alarm clock. Bird enthusiasts such as Harris Nature Center bird naturalist Claire Bratton have been venturing out more and more lately, binoculars at the ready. WKAR's Peter Wharf caught up with Claire at the Harris Nature Center recently as she prepared for one of her regular educational sessions.
We're going to spend the first part of the session indoors and just get some of the basics down. There's a lot of things that new birders, even if they've been out some, don't quite grasp some of the finer points of what makes birding easier.
What would be some of those things that people don't know about?
How to focus binoculars, just basically how to use binoculars, right, and all the different focusing mechanisms and various things on the binoculars that you use, and then just how to use them once you're in the field, how to find that bird. I mean, you can find it with your eyes, and then they kind of put the binoculars up and they can't find it anywhere. So we can give them some tips on how to do that real easily.
I'm going to ask you for some of those tips today, because I find that I'm not very good at using the binoculars to spot birds. Like you say, okay, I'll listen first and then I'll spot them, and then I can't find them with
binoculars. Well, the first and easiest thing to do, I mean, it's so simple that you think, well, why didn't I think of that? You don't take your eye off the bird. When you're looking at the bird, you keep your face and in there and look at the bird, and then just pick up the binoculars and put them up in front of your face, and then you're looking at the bird. People have a tendency to look down to pick up the binoculars. And when they put them up, the binoculars in front of their face, and then they can't find the bird. So keep your nose pointed at the bird and just lift the binoculars up.
Right. Talk to me about some of the differences this time of year. We're here in early April. What are we hearing and seeing differently than, say, a month or two ago? When is sort of the transitional time?
Well, for the birds that have been here all winter, you hear chips and chirps all right, winter long. But once the day length starts to change and the sun comes out, you start hearing their songs. Songs are territorial issues. It tells other birds of their species that I'm looking for a mate and this is my area. So they
haven't really gone anywhere, but no, we're hearing a difference now.
Yes, they are. Birds don't have just one call or one voice or one song. We keep seeing the song of. Well, there's not just one the. There's many, many different sounds that birds make. And so some more than others, but a lot of them are just call notes, you know, talking to each other.
Right.
But when spring comes, then you get into the song. The chickadee, the familiar chickadee-dee-dee-dee, is just a call. It's just a, hey, I'm here, and, you know, where are you? But in the spring, you get that dee-dee-dee-dee, and that's their spring song, which doesn't sound as much of a song to us, but it does it for them.
Well, let's go and walk a bit and see what we can see and hear.
Okay. I hear a junco over there. the Juncos are singing, and they start their spring song here, start practicing, but they'll be moving further north, the Juncos, the gray birds with the white bellies that are around here in the wintertime.
Is that an LBJ?
No.
I remember that from last time.
LBJs are brown birds.
Okay. Little brown job.
These are gray jobs.
Okay.
But they're pretty distinctive. You know, they look like they have on a gray coat with a white tummy.
Right.
And so they're on their way out. They'll be gone within the next probably 2 weeks, and you won't see them anymore.
Where will they go?
Northern Michigan,
yeah.
Up into Canada,
right.
And they do their breeding up there.
Have they had a distant migration?
Not necessarily. They do, I mean, you can find them clear down into the southern states in the wintertime, but then they can go into some mountain areas, higher elevation, cooler areas, and even blue jays. They do short range. The blue jay you saw all winter may not be the blue jay that nests in your yard.
Really?
They do
different ones?
Different ones.
Yeah.
They do short-range migrations. So we get the ones from northern Michigan come down here. The ones from here go down into Ohio and Illinois and Indiana. And,
yeah.
So everybody's moving around and trying to find the perfect spot to do their nesting. Oh, there's a nuthatch.
See a nuthatch?
I heard one.
Oh, you heard one. Okay.
That little nasal.
Oh, yeah.
He's going down the tree. He's the downy bird.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
They come headfirst down the side of a trunk of a tree.
Who's that guy right there about?
That's the nuthatch.
There's one about 40 feet in front of us.
Oh, out there?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a whole group of them in here. There's one on this larger tree right here, too. I think he...
Don't even need the binoculars for those.
No. There's a cluster of them right here for some
quite a
reason.
Few.
But, yeah, they're all nuthatches. I thought maybe we'd see hear a tufted titmouse because they've been singing, too, but... I haven't heard any today. Birdwatchers should also know tree names.
Oh, yeah. That tree.
That tree.
Birdwatchers need to identify trees as well.
Once you get into birdwatching, you get into all kinds of other things because you're out and you're walking around and seeing different things.
Oh,
and, you know, when the spring flowers are blooming and somebody always got...
Naturalist Claire Bratton with WKAR's Peter Wharf at Meridian Township's Harris Nature Center. Claire regularly leads educational sessions throughout mid-Michigan. It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. At the end of each month, we check in with Great Lakes commentator and journalist Gary Wilson for updates on environmental stories from around the basin. For today's Great Lakes Month in Review, we're focusing on agriculture and water across the country from California to the Great Lakes, and we'll hear about the White House's plans to enlist farmers to combat climate change. Gary Wilson, welcome back to Current State.
Good morning, Mark. Good to be with you, and nice to hear about the birds of spring.
That's right. They're a lot more active here just in the last couple of weeks, and Lansing has its first nesting bald eagle in possibly a century, so it's created a stir. Let's talk about places where there is a significant water problem here amid their worsening drought. People in California are being forced to live with dramatically reduced water supplies, and that has some worried about whether or not the thirsty, arid West could come looking for water where it's more abundant, like, say, the Great Lakes. Now, experts say that's highly unlikely because of legal and economic barriers. Can you talk to us about some of those barriers?
I'd be glad to, Mark. Yes, and that the California issue is all over the national and the local news. People pay attention to what happens in California, especially when it comes to water. The first barrier, Mark, is the Great Lakes Compact, and I think your listeners probably remember going back to 2008 when it was enacted, and that's the 8-state agreement plus 2 Canadian provinces that was signed into law in 2008 by President Bush, and it prohibits the export of water from the Great Lakes region. At the law, and the compact is very legal, heavily legalized, heavily lawyered, as it was said. Compacts are considered to be strong medicine. That's what one Detroit water lawyer has consistently told me. The Compacts are viewed as strong deterrents to anybody that that may want Great Lakes water. The economic barriers relate to distance and expense. Pipelines cost in the billions of dollars, and they take years to build, and they're politically charged. All you have to do is look at the Keystone Pipeline issues. Yes, they're feasible, but you know, pipelines are not easily or quickly done. Never say never about shipping Great Lakes water to California, but there's not real serious discussion about it at this point.
Well, a recent Chicago Tribune editorial said the Great Lakes Compact is sacrosanct until it isn't. Can you expand on that?
Sure. Congress passed the Great Lakes Compact. President Bush signed it. But what Congress giveth, Congress can taketh away, as they say, no matter what the Great Lakes states may want. What the Tribune's referring to, and what I have often said, is that the compact is sacrosanct up to a point. I say it's written in number two pencil, not dark red ink, and it could be subject to political machinations. If there were dire conditions somewhere, it's not a stretch to believe that Congress, under humanitarian and political pressure, wouldn't make changes to the compact. It's not outside of the realm of possibility, and it's something to be aware of. I hear too many times people say, oh, we're protected because of the compact. Well, we are to a point, but it doesn't mean it's forever.
Gary Wilson is a Great Lakes journalist and commentator. It's current state's Great Lakes Month in Review. Some Great Lakes activists and experts, Gary, say the real threat comes from within the region. Waukesha, Wisconsin is the most high-profile example. What are those threats?
Well, I think, we've talked a lot about Waukesha for years, and you and I have talked about it a number of times. And it's still pending. I think the biggest threat from in the region is the failure of the states, the eight states, to make and enact binding rules for how to review applications for water. Now, this sounds like, you know, bureaucratic minutia, but it's very important. Without the rules on how to deal with diversion requests, that means that any decisions made by the governors could be viewed as arbitrary. And when you get into the legal weeds, arbitrary is not a good thing to have a decision based on. It's a weakness, and it's one that could be exploited by towns just outside the region who may want Great Lakes water and may need it. And those towns are out there: Pewaukee, Wisconsin; Lowell, Indiana; Wadsworth, Ohio, are just a few of them that could be in similar situations to Waukesha. They're likely to need a water source soon, maybe 2 years, maybe 5 years, maybe 10 years. It's not that far away. The demand is there. It's important to tighten up these restrictions, these regulations.
Agriculture and climate have made big news outside of California, too. Last week, Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack was here in East Lansing to talk about new measures that ask farmers to significantly cut down their emissions by 2025. What new measures is Secretary Vilsack referring to?
Sure, Mark. When the Secretary visited East Lansing, he talked about a list of 10 conservation, in quoting, building blocks. These building blocks are listed on the USDA website, and they actually make for fairly boring reading to a layperson like me. But they're important for agricultural conversation. They're essentially a list of best conservation practices, things like no-till farming and using cover crops. These things help keep CO2 in the ground. Also, controlling nitrous oxide, another contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. And the list goes on. There are eight other of these building blocks. They get deeper into the weeds of farming practices. They make for good reading for scientists on the MSU campus and elsewhere, and farmers, but they're a little bit like a foreign language to the rest of us. That doesn't mean they're not important.
What's the Obama administration's reasoning for introducing the new measures now?
That's a great question, Mark, and it really gets to the point of the issue. There are two reasons. First, the Obama administration is committed to overall greenhouse gas emissions of about 25%. By 2025. Experts who track these things don't see how it's possible without a contribution from agriculture. And historically, agriculture has been seen as getting a pass on tough environmental rules. That's still the case. The USDA plan that Secretary Vilsack talked about in his dancing still relies on farmers to voluntarily adopt those measures. And that could be the Achilles heel.
Has the farming community responded to this?
Well, farmers tend to view government interventions and forays with skepticism. You have to remember that farmers as a group tend to be politically conservative, and they have an inherent skepticism for government programs. But I think they're also relieved, at least for the short term, because these proposals are voluntary. Plus, they come with some financial incentives, so that always gets the farmers' attention. The financial incentives, though, have a downside for taxpayers like the rest of us, because essentially what we're doing is paying farmers not to pollute. We don't do that with other industries like manufacturing. We fine them when they pollute. But farmers have always had a special place in our culture, and they continue to hold that place, although they are being subject to more scrutiny now on their environmental practices.
How have environmental groups been responding to this relatively new focus on agriculture as a pollution source?
Mark, I think they're trying to figure it out. Agriculture has always been a tough group for environmental groups to take on when it comes to regulations. All we have to do is look what's happened over the last year or so in Ohio with the agricultural pollution that contributed to the Toledo water crisis. That had been brewing for some time, and nobody was surprised when it happened. You know, I've talked to a number of Great Lakes environmental activists, and they've been loath over the years to call for regulations because it's been seen as a political non-starter. But the voluntary measures haven't worked, so environmental groups have been, they're kind of caught in a no-man's land. I happened to talk with Molly Flanagan about this. Molly Flanagan is the new policy director for the Alliance for the Great Lakes, one of the major groups in the region. She says that dealing with agricultural pollution is one of her top priorities. Good for her, and that's easy to say, but it's much more difficult when you start to try to manage it. So we'll have to see how it plays out. They've got a steep hill to climb when it comes to dealing with agriculture.
We've been reviewing this month's biggest environmental news stories with Gary Wilson, Great Lakes journalist and commentator. Thanks for joining us, Gary.
Always good to be with you, Mark, and I'll see you next month.
Very good. This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. And coming up on Current State, a new documentary from students in MSU's College of Communication Arts looks at life for LGBTQ youth growing up in small-town Michigan. It follows Chris Ryan, a young gay man who grew up in Gaylord. We talk to Chris about his life and his experience making the movie. Plus, Stephen Terry has nearly 1,000 vintage postcards, many of them of Michigan State University. Stephen joins us to talk about his book, which looks at the history of MSU Agricultural College in postcard form. That's coming up.
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Lourdes Garcia,
Ari Shapiro,
NPR News,
Monrovia,
Sao Paulo, Beirut,
London. Reporting from bunkers, streets, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly, we're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
The morning's news on your way to work between 5 and 9 on 90.5 WKAR. WKAR is supported by Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, a business networking and advocacy organization in the greater Lansing community for more than 100 years. Membership information can be found at lansingchamber.org. And by Hayes Green Beach Memorial Hospital, offering an array of health and well-being experiences through Alive, its health park in Charlotte, fitness center, spa services, children's recreation, and more. MyAlive.com.
its current state on WKAR. Joshua Davis made another appearance on NBC's The Voice last night, the longtime frontman of the Lansing band stepping in it, sang the Sting song Fields of Gold.
You remember me when the west wind moves among the fields of barley. You can tell the sun in his jealous sky when we walk through fields of gold.
Joshua Davis will find out tonight if he advances from the top eight to the top six on NBC TV's The Voice. Mark Bayshore here on Current State from 90.5 WKAR and AM 870 WKAR. The lives of LGBTQ Americans are more visible than they've ever been before. In the past decade, the number of television shows and movies that feature gay, lesbian, and transgender characters has exploded. Celebrities and public figures are more open about their sexual orientations. Earlier in the program, we talked about the U.S. Supreme Court case that could make gay marriage legal in all 50 states. Many say the increasing acceptance of the LGBTQ community in the public eye has made it easier for younger generations to come out to family and friends. But for kids growing up in smaller, often more conservative towns, deciding to be honest about their sexual orientations can be a tough decision. The Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network says youth in rural and small-town schools often face more bullying and have fewer resources available than their urban and suburban peers. That's the subject of a new documentary from students in the MSU College of Communication Arts and Sciences. Gay from Gaylord looks at what it's like to grow up gay in small-town Michigan through the story of Chris Ryan, now a junior at Michigan State. Chris joins us now to talk about his life growing up in Gaylord and his experience producing a documentary about his own life. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Starting out, talk to us about growing up in Gaylord, Michigan. It's a community I know a little bit about. A lot of our listeners have probably passed through Gaylord one time or another. What was it like for you?
Yeah, it's right on I-75 up north, just an hour south of the bridge, and it is a very, very Catholic, non-diverse town. So growing up as a minority, it was quite an interesting experience. I faced a lot of adversity, whether that be bullying or name-calling, all that, which led to a really rocky high school experience and adolescence, which then led to a difficult home life and a lot of issues with depression and all of that.
You describe these as the worst years of your life.
Yes, I talk about it in the film about these being the worst years of my life. And luckily,
What was the hardest part of that?
The hardest part of that was the fact that I couldn't elaborate to anyone. I had to keep all my feelings inside of me because even though I didn't know what gay was really, because there was no knowledge of that culture up north, I knew that it was wrong. So I had to keep all of these feelings within myself.
When you were growing up there, was anybody in Gaylord openly gay?
No, I didn't meet my first gay person until my junior year of high school. So that was, just knowing I was that different is quite an experience.
And they were not from Gaylord? They were from some other place? Or
they were actually from Gaylord, and I ended up dating that person. So,
But it was a very well-kept secret.
Correct.
Is that the kind
yes.
of thing? Okay. When did you come out to your friends and family?
I came out to my friends and family the end of my senior year. I came out to them by going to prom with my then-boyfriend.
And what kind of reaction did you get?
It was a mixed ball. My friends and family are very supportive and continue to support me in everything that I do.
That must have been a huge relief, though. I mean, your family was more supportive, and your friends were more supportive than you would have anticipated.
I knew that I aligned myself with people that love me and I love them. But my family is a Catholic family, including myself. So it was a big sigh of relief to know that my family will still accept me for whatever I do.
Your relationship with your parents, would you say it got better or did it get worse before it got better?
It most certainly got better right from the start. I had self-hatred that led to mutual aggression and destruction in the home life. But then as soon as that came out, I knew I could be myself and present myself in a new light, which led to a better bond between my family and myself.
Chris Ryan is our guest. Chris is a junior here at Michigan State University, and he's talking about his life growing up in Gaylord, and it's chronicled in the new movie produced by the Michigan State University College of Communication Arts and Sciences, Gay from Gaylord. It is about the challenges of growing up gay in a relatively smaller community. This is interesting. You started getting seriously involved in stand-up comedy when you got to Michigan State University. Tell us about what was it that made you want to do stand-up comedy?
Well, being so shy and so in my shell in high school, I kind of turned to the internet as an escape from reality. So I started producing little comedy videos online, which then led me, when I came to State and realized that I could have a voice and have a platform, I knew I really liked making people laugh. So I tried stand-up comedy at a local competition, and I ended up winning my first month here at college as a freshman. So since then, I kind of hit the ground running and just have been trying to get as many gigs as possible, traveling around the state and making people giggle and laugh.
Did that offer some kind of catharsis from everything that you had gone through?
Almost certainly. I think
it seemed
really
like it
come
would
full
yeah.
circle, and it's been a great experience, which is kind of really what the film delves into.
How did your experiences growing up in Gaylord influence your comedy? Do you think they did influence your comedy?
Most certainly. I always say that comedy comes from pain. So the fact that I have gone through a lot of issues, it allows me to make a lot of material shedding light on those issues while still making people laugh.
Have you run into many other people in the LGBTQ community here on campus who had experiences similar to yours?
In regards to bullying and adversity, most certainly. It's kind of a thing that you go through growing up LGBTQ that unfortunately hasn't, it's changing with the new generation, but it's still a problem. So hopefully my movie sends a message of acceptance and being able to share your voice without consequence.
Do you view yourself as a trailblazer in Gaylord?
I don't know if
it sounds like maybe you could.
I would like to hope that I have inspired some of my friends or closeted individuals back home to find their voice. I don't necessarily view myself as a role model, but if I can help someone in some way, fantastic, and my job here is done.
How did you respond when this idea for the film first came up? Did you take a while to evaluate, hey, do I want this story on film, or did you just go for it immediately? Did you really like the idea?
At first, I was a little bit apprehensive because it's throwing my whole life, all of the most serious aspects of my life that sometimes I like to hide out there. But then again, I'm a stand-up comedian, so I like attention. So I knew that I wanted the story told.
What was it like to see some of your story on screen?
It's been really therapeutic and meta. It's so weird seeing me on the big screen talking about my most deep problems, but then I had to talk through them so many times where it's like kind of been a free therapy session, which has been really great.
Interesting. What's been the reaction from members of your hometown about the documentary? Any response there?
Yeah, I keep getting messages and letters from people back home saying, I really wish there was someone like you back when my brother was growing up and wasn't able to find a voice for himself. He waited until he was 40 years old to come out, that type of scenario. I keep getting messages from former teachers, family, friends, and it's been really great to see that the acceptance of myself and the film and my project has been so universally positive. And I'm really hoping that continues because I'm so passionate about what we have done.
Popular attitudes seem to have changed really suddenly, relatively suddenly,
mm-hmm.
which do you feel like attitudes in Gaylord are changing as well then? It sounds like they are.
Yeah, I think it really comes with the new generation of people, as you can see in the Supreme Court right now and all of that. I think times are changing, and I have a positive attitude towards it. And I think it's just a matter of time with people like myself and other individuals who aren't afraid to stand up for what they believe in, spreading the message. And then I think acceptance will be further widespread.
Who do you hope to reach most with the documentary? And I'm curious if it's younger people or if it's older people.
I think it could reach both, but I think more importantly, it's younger people, adolescents, because I wish when I was 13 and 14, going through all my issues of depression and suicidal actions, that I had someone to look up to say, that can be me in a couple years. I just have to keep going, and it does get better, and you get better. So I think that that's very important.
Chris Ryan is the subject of a new documentary from students in the MSU College of Communication Arts and Sciences. Gay from Gaylord looks at what it's like to grow up gay in small town Michigan through Chris's story. He is now a junior at Michigan State University. Good luck, Chris.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Our next guest is the proud author of a 2015 Michigan notable book. Stephen Terry of Williamston is also the first ever deltaologist to appear on Current State. That's a collector of picture postcards. Mr. Terry's collection numbers around 1,000. A specialty is postcards featuring images of the MSU, or more correctly, the Michigan Agricultural College campus from about a century ago. They are the focus of Mr. Terry's recent book, Michigan Agricultural College Campus Life, 1900 to 1925, A Postcard Tour. Stephen Terry, welcome to Current State.
Thank you for inviting me.
Of all the collecting bugs to get bitten by, how exactly did this one get started?
Well, my wife is an antique dealer, and or was at the time, some 30 years ago, and we went to a lot of shows and things, and I discovered that there were postcard dealers at these shows. Mm. And after looking through some of the cards, I found out that they had sections on Michigan State. So I began collecting them, just Michigan State cards. There are a lot of other people who collect cards on a lot of other topics, but Michigan State was always my interest.
What accounts for all these MAC postcards? Who were the primary buyers of these? Do you know?
Well, back at the turn of the 20th century, it was the beginning of a period when postcards became just a craze throughout the country. The post office began allowing postcards in the early, about 1901 or 1902. And in a country that had maybe 75 million people, by 1907, there were 1 billion postcards being mailed every year. It was a way to communicate at the time. Cards were cheap, cost a penny to mail, and it was a way to communicate back home before the television. And, of course, they couldn't tweet each other and things like that. So the postcard became very popular.
I am looking at the most extraordinary image, one that you would not expect to find in a book that we have just been described. But here are two large groups of presumably MAC students from what year, I do not know, but this is a good century ago. Company D charging Company B, bayonets fixed. Sham battle, MAC.
That would have been around the time of the First World War, 1916 to 1918, when much of the campus was turned over for military activities.
It is the most interesting image. Do you know where that took place? Is there any way of knowing where that happened?
Probably on what's known today as Adams Field. That was the main drill ground and assembly ground for the military activities at the time.
It's an extraordinary image on page 34 of Steve Terry's book. Steve's the author of a 2015 Michigan notable book. We're talking about it here today. He is a collector of picture postcards that focus on the Michigan Agricultural College campus from about a century ago. I read that the era that many of these cards are from is considered the golden age of postcards, 1900
Correct.
To 1925. Why is that considered the golden age?
Well, it was a time when the industry was new. The postcard was a relatively new phenomenon, and it was produced in ways that are very different than are produced today. Many of them are actually real photographs. Back about 1907, Kodak introduced a camera that took postcard-size film, and you could simply go to your local postcard or film processor and have them print your pictures on a postcard stock, and you could mail it to your friends. Mm. So there was a tremendous variety of these cards, and they were primarily all black and white. There were color cards at the time, but for the most part, they were black and white, and it was just a way to communicate back home.
Now, you mentioned 1907, and what immediately comes to mind is the fact that Theodore Roosevelt visited East Lansing in 1907. Do you happen to know, was there a postcard created of that?
Yes, there was. As a matter of fact, I have it right here.
Oh, okay.
And it's in the book, at the kind of the last page of the book, of Theodore Roosevelt addressing the assembled multitude for commencement.
Well, it's an enormous crowd.
There were 20,000 people. And this is a time, of course, before, here we're sitting with all this electronic equipment around us. There was no such equipment back then. He had to speak to that huge crowd of people with the sound of only his own voice. And there were people at the fringes of that crowd who complained about not being able to hear very well.
See, now I would think Teddy Roosevelt was up to the task.
He was.
He figured out a way. President Roosevelt addressing students and alumni of MAC graduating exercises and 50th anniversary celebration, May 31st, 1907. How many images are in the book about?
There's a little over 200 postcards in the book.
Focus on one that you consider exceptionally interesting and tell us why.
Sure, here you go. It's a building burning down. In 1916, the engineering building burned down. And one of the interesting thing about postcards, of course, is I can show you a card of that building before it burned. You're holding a card of the building actually burning, and here's a card taken the next day of the remains of the building.
Charred remains of the building also became a picture postcard.
Yes,
how interesting.
And here's another whole set of a building that was attached to that building that also burned.
This is the...
It's this kind of thing that makes this era so interesting.
Engineering building, Mac Burns, March 5th, 1916. Do you evaluate these at all in terms of the messages written on the postcards, or is it strictly the image?
Well, you'll notice that that particular card has no message. It's actually unused.
Correct.
And many people collected cards even beginning at during this era in the early 1900s. Many of the others, of course, were sent home to family and friends. And when they were sent home, they were sent with the message. Very, very often, the message that's on the back of the card had nothing whatever to do with the picture that's on the card, because it was just a way of communicating at the time.
After all these years, I would assume the campus has changed too much for many of the images to be recognizable. Or would I be wrong? Can you actually sort out where these places are?
It took quite some time as I started collecting these cards to realize that there are parts of the campus that are very much like they were in the early 1900s. If you drive around Circle Drive, that was the original center of the campus, and most of the buildings around Circle Drive date from an era around 1925 or earlier. Ag Hall, for example, there's a row of buildings to the north of Ag Hall as you go around Circle Drive that are known as Laboratory Row.
Mm-hmm.
All of those buildings were built in the 1800s. The building across the street, which used to be the old administration building, is now Linton Hall. That's the oldest building on the campus. The older part of it is. The museum used to be the library, built in the 1920s. But at the end of the period that this book covers, which is 1925, of all the buildings that were on the campus at that time, there's only about a dozen left, and most of them are around Circle Drive.
We're talking with Steve Terry, author of the recent book, Michigan Agricultural College Campus Life, 1900 to 1925, a postcard tour. It's all collected in Mr. Terry's 2015 Michigan Notable Book of the same name. I imagine a market develops for some postcards, and that's how some come to be a lot more valuable than others. What kinds of images fetch the highest prices?
Well, for example, the images of the fire that we just talked about, those, if you look on the back, the prices are still on the back of some of those cards. I paid $30 or $35 a piece.
$28 firm for the image of the engineering building actually on fire.
Correct. Yeah. Many of the cards that are of less interest, actually the cards to me that are of the most interest are the ones that have people in them, because postcards today typically don't have people in them.
Okay.
And these were taken, gives you a kind of a slice of life of what it looked like around the campus when people were actually there and participating in activities and so on. And I find those to be most interesting. And generally speaking, they carry a higher price tag.
I want to go Antiques Roadshow with you for just one second, and if I could, ask you what your collection is worth, roughly. Do you know?
No, I don't know. Okay. I've never tried to add it up, and I think I would rather not try and add it up.
Is it insured?
Yeah, sure.
It is. Mm-hmm. Deltiology was described in my research as the third most popular form of collecting after stamps and coins.
Yeah, that's correct.
Does that surprise you or not?
Well, it doesn't surprise me because I've been doing this for so long. There are postcard shows scattered around the area. There are a number of them in Michigan each year.
Yeah.
There's Ray Walsh from Curious Books does the antiquarian book and paper show at the Lansing Center twice a year, which has a large contingent of postcard dealers, among others. But there are a lot of places that you can go and buy these postcards. And, of course, eBay has changed the world in this area, as it has and everything to do with antiques.
It's a really enjoyable read if you have any kinds of roots in the Lansing, East Lansing community, and it's a 2015 Michigan Notable book. Michigan Agricultural College Campus Life, 1900 to 1925, a postcard tour. Our guest has been Stephen Terry. Thank you, Stephen.
Thanks for being here.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we continue our conversation about sex ed in Michigan schools with Democratic State Senator Curtis Hertel. Senator Hertel's in the process of crafting new legislation that would update state laws about teaching abstinence in public schools. Plus, Downton Abbey fans had the chance to see the show like they've never seen it before, performed entirely by one man and mixing in Keeping Up with the Kardashians and Dancing with the Stars. Scott Pohl talks to writer and star of America's Got Downton, a parody of the popular PBS series, which comes to the Wharton Center this Thursday. Current State's executive producer is Peter Worf. April Van Buren directed our show today. Thanks also to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, and to Drew Hill for engineering. Past episodes at WKAR.org or subscribe to our podcast, please. We're on Facebook. Search Current State from WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Current State, have a great day.